Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
All right, on the program today, we've got three I's. I'm talking about the letter I. Infrastructure, international travel, and of course, you guessed it, inflation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Khreis in for Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, August 11th. Good to have you along. So the big economic news of the day, and let's be real, it'll probably get sliced and diced for the rest of the month, is inflation. As you may have already heard, CPI, the Consumer Price Index, rose 5.4% year over year in July, and the index is at a 13-year high. But month to month, prices rose less in July than they did in June, and core inflation, which strips out food and energy, also grew at a slower monthly pace. Prices for used cars and airline tickets, which had been going up crazy fast in May and June, barely budged in July. Now, Fed Chair Jay Powell has been saying all along that this surge of inflation is transitory, driven by supply chain bottlenecks and reopening pains. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains, today's CPI report backs up that short-term inflation narrative, for the most part.
With prices moderating for many items related to reopening the pandemic economy, Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics says Fed officials, investors, and consumers can breathe.
A sigh of relief that the burst of higher prices and the surge in inflation that we've seen over the previous few months now seems to be fading.
But what about inflation for food away from home? That's going out to eat. Prices kept rising sharply in July, along with wages for waiters, cooks, and bartenders.
Those wage increases just aren't going to turn into a level of aggregate demand that will result in inflation.
Joseph Bruzuelas at RSM says even if they are getting big pay hikes, these lower-income service workers aren't rich enough and don't spend enough to raise prices economy-wide. And Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute says some wage inflation for these workers is fine.
People are going out to restaurants again, and wages and employment are both rising. And until we see evidence that the fast wage growth is like choking off employment growth, I think we just have to say that's really good. Restaurant workers actually have some bargaining power they traditionally do not have.
But in housing, there is a growing inflation risk, says Eric Friedman at U.S. Bank.
We do think that rent increases will likely be the path forward.
With home prices surging and the Delta variant making people's office and housing plans more uncertain, Friedman says rents are set to jump later this year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Yesterday on the program, we talked about the infrastructure bill that just passed. More specifically, we looked at some provisions in that bill aimed at mitigating wildfires and their impact. And today, we are turning our attention to other parts of the bill that could have a direct impact on the size and spread of those wildfires. I am talking about energy infrastructure, because as Marketplace's Andy Eula reports, the investment in the clean energy transformation that the Biden administration has been touting seems to be getting underway with this bill.
After bridges and roads, the biggest ticket item as it stands at more than $70 billion is upgrading the electricity grid and power infrastructure. Joshua Rhodes is a research associate with the Weber Energy Group at the University of Texas at Austin. He says that's an investment in the future.
If we're going to run more of our grid off of renewables, we're probably going to have to build more transmission lines to move that power longer distances. And some of the things in this bill do put money towards that.
The bill also allocates some $15 billion for electric vehicle infrastructure, including more charging stations along highways, and $40 billion to make public transit more environmentally friendly. David Pello is a professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
The public transit piece is way, way more important. We're going to get way more bang for our buck.
Specifically, he says, from things like low-emission buses, ferries, and school buses. Now, this bill could do more to address climate change reality, says Jennifer Haverkamp. She's director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan, and she also worked in environmental policy in the Obama State Department. But, she says,
it's a significant move in the right direction with some good elements in there, and especially important for what it signals about a bipartisan recognition of the importance of addressing climate change infrastructure.
She says she's now turned her attention to additional climate change policy funding in the budget reconciliation bill that just passed in the Senate. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street today had its eyes on that consumer price index. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Brexit continues to send ripples through the British economy. Universities are the latest sector to take a hit. The number of students from the European Union applying to UK schools has dropped dramatically, down 43% this year. Since British higher education is heavily dependent on fees from overseas students, on its face, this looks like a disaster. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, it is actually not as bad as it seems.
There's little doubt why EU students are steering clear of British schools, says Vivian Stern of lobby group Universities UK.
I think it's an inevitable consequence of the change in EU student status following the UK's departure from the European Union.
Most EU students are now treated as foreigners in the UK without the financial benefits enjoyed by their British counterparts. Brian Pepin is with the UK's University Admission Service.
Many students from the European Union are no longer eligible for home fees or financial support.
Their tuition is no longer capped, as it is for Brits, at $12,700 a year. The average fee for foreign students is more than $21,000. The decline in EU interest is understandable, says Vivian Stern.
Really, the demand is being suppressed by the feeling that the UK is more unaffordable now than it was.
But is the sharp drop in EU applicants a severe hit to British universities?
This is going to probably sound surprising. It's not a financial blow at all.
Nick Hillman of the Higher Education Policy Institute says, don't forget that even though EU applications are 43% down overall, there are still 28,400 EU students who have applied to come to the UK this year.
Because they'll be paying those much higher fees, the actual amount of money the universities are getting may very well not fall at all. They could get just as much money to educate fewer students.
And there's more room for more lucrative foreign students from outside the EU. Applications from them are up 14% this year. But there is one worry. China, which has strained relations with Britain, has by far the largest group of foreign students in the UK.
If tensions between the UK government and China continue to be ramped up, then it could have a knock-on consequence.
It seems unlikely, he says, but if Beijing were to order home all or many of the 100,000 Chinese students in the UK, it could leave a very large hole in British university finances. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
By the way, if you want more Marketplace content, y'all should check out the Marketplace podcast that I host called This is Uncomfortable. It's a show that explores our relationship with money and work. And we have a newsletter, too. This week, you can read about how I gave up my credit cards and only used cash for a week. It wasn't easy. You can subscribe at marketplace.org/newsletters. 'Tis the season of back-to-school shopping. Retailers are expecting record spending. But even though the economy is in recovery, a lot of folks are still struggling. Charitable groups and local governments across the country are holding some back-to-school events. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams checked one out in D.C., where almost 2,000 families showed up for free school supplies.
I met Alexis Whitley in the parking lot outside the Get Ready for School giveaway held on a recent Saturday in Southeast Washington. She showed up with her five children half an hour early. Whitley says she's been out of work since the start of the pandemic.
I was actually working at the National Stadium, and they shut it down last year due to COVID. And my kids have been homeschooled since that.
She's looking for a job, but it's hard to get reliable childcare.
Well, money is very tight, you know. Me paying bills, you know, electric, gas, rent, water bill. My money is very tight.
Do you pre-register? You can check in with her right over there.
Even though this is billed as a back-to-school event, the rows of tables under the large outdoor pavilion also have baby clothes and adult undergarments, masks, hand sanitizer, and free groceries. One of the most popular tables had stacks of school uniforms.
There are two 12s, and I'll get a 14. You are a very popular size.
Organizers say more people are showing up to events like this due to the pandemic's economic costs. But there's also more stuff to give away. Monumental Sports and Entertainment Foundation, the charitable arm of Washington sports teams, the Capitals, Mystics, and Wizards, donated T-shirts and towels and sports gear they couldn't sell at closed stadiums, and threw in an appearance by the Washington Wizards dancers. Many of the other items at this giveaway came from Hanes, Jockey, American Eagle Outfitters, Gerber Children's Wear. It all came from the group Delivering Good, which takes excess inventory from companies and routes it through charities. Lisa Gerwich is the group's president and CEO.
In 2020, we distributed the most that we have ever distributed in our 36-year history. So 70, that's 70 million items to people in need.
Usually, it's more like 10 to 11 million items. Gerwich says the big jump in donations, like the jump in demand for them, is due to the pandemic.
Well, we know that we went through a retail apocalypse when everybody was closed, and then many companies had to close at least some of their stores permanently, and those were tough decisions.
By donating their excess inventory rather than destroying it or sending it to landfills, companies can get some tax benefits and, says Gerwich, show they're helping out.
Consumers want to know that the companies are doing good. Their associates and employees want to know that. Their investors, their boards.
Extra inventory has been one of the struggles for retailers throughout the pandemic, says Lauren Biedelsbacher, who teaches marketing at Babson College.
So the worst thing that a retailer can do is not have a good that a consumer wants. The second worst thing a retailer can do is have too much of a good that a consumer doesn't want.
Biedelsbacher says the pandemic has made it extremely challenging for businesses to thread that needle. Retailers could sit on unsold inventory with hopes of selling it later, but they often have contractual obligations to their vendors.
So even if they had excess inventory from last year that they held on to, they still had maybe some obligations to some of their top vendors to continue to buy stuff going into the school year.
For thousands of families that showed up to the event in D.C., all that donated merchandise means a lot of items crossed off the back-to-school shopping list, like for Alexis Whitley and her kids.
So we've got glue, paper, notebooks, composition books, uniforms, some fruit. A lot of things, pencils, crayons.
I got me some chips and a bottle and paper.
And with all that, the family is much closer to being ready for fall. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they're looking to plan sort of big bucket list trips.
Yeah, can't blame them. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones rose 220 points, 0.6% to finish at 35,484. The NASDAQ lost 22 points, 0.1% to end at 14,765. And the S&P 500 added 10 points, 0.25% to land at 44.47. One note on the CPI that Mitchell Hartman talked about. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says its index for fruits and vegetables was the only major grocery store food group to see prices fall in July, with fresh fruit down 1.8%. Andy Euler talked about the infrastructure bill. Investors seem to think that steel is going to benefit from the measure. Companies like steel giant Nucor heated up nearly 4%, and Schnitzer Steel tacked on 3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. At some point, you may have had this experience. I know I have. You open up the fridge and you notice that the milk jug is a day or two or three past the sell-by date. Maybe you smell it, maybe you give it a quick taste, or maybe you ask your partner what they think. And then you take a closer look again at that sell-by date. But do we actually know what that label is telling us? According to Alyssa Wilkinson at Vox, the answer is probably no. She had a story looking at what goes into those labels, and she joined me to chat about it. Alyssa, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
So I am so excited to chat with you because I'm just like fascinated by this topic. You wrote about the expiration dates we see on food and how they are in fact not expiration dates.
Right. That's right. They don't even claim to be expiration dates, but that's how we often think about them.
Well okay. Then what are they?
For most of them, they're actually something that often gets called freshness dates or best by dates sometimes.
Okay.
And the idea is that they tell us when the manufacturer or packager or distributor of the food thinks that it will be best tasting or have the best texture or something like that. But what they don't indicate is whether it will hurt you in any way to eat it if it's gone a little past the date.
So they are not expiration dates. They are like freshness labels. So how did they come to be?
It sort of starts right after World War II. And at the time, there weren't any dates on any of these foods.
Okay.
But the manufacturer sometimes would put these codes on them that would indicate to the grocer that this was sort of like when you might want to rotate your stock. Mm. And manufacturers realized that these dates could actually be kind of used as marketing if they were legible to your average consumer. And there have been efforts since then to standardize them in some way,
you know,
across the country, but they've never succeeded. So there's only one federal regulation, and it is for infant formula, and that's an important nutritional thing. But for most other foods, it goes state by state. Sometimes it's a suggestion or a guideline that, for instance, milk lasts for 21 days or 14 days.
It just varies from state to state. Wow.
So if you're buying something from a big food manufacturer, the date might come from a focus group that they did where they sort of had them eat foods at different stages and then just sort of pick the one that was the consensus that this is when it tastes most appealing or where the texture is most appealing. Of course, lots of small manufacturers can't do that at all. So they're essentially making it up or making an educated guess. And that's where most of these dates come from.
And I'm sure like from manufacturers' perspective, they would argue that these labels are legitimate because they want you to eat something when it tastes its absolute best, right? In order to protect their brand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, that sometimes makes us think that if we're eating the food and it's short-coded, that we might be like risking our lives or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's simply not true. And the end result of that is that grocery stores end up throwing out an incredible amount of their stock because people won't buy it, and because they buy more to fill the shelves, because who wants to shop in an empty looking grocery store?
Wow.
And the end result is we're wasting about 40% of the food we produce in the U.S. And at the same time, it's an enormous amount. And at the same time, we have about roughly 42 million people who are living with some kind of food insecurity situation. So that's a big problem. And fixing labels isn't the only way to fix the problem, but it definitely would go a long way.
So I'm curious now, just like on a personal level, how has knowing all of this changed your own relationship with food and expiration dates, or quote unquote expiration dates? See, yeah, I'm getting it wrong right now.
Well, so one thing I started doing is I definitely don't call them expiration dates anymore, or I like stop myself when I say it, because I want to actually think about what they are properly. Mm-hmm. And I really was a stickler for throwing away anything that was past the date at any time.
Same.
And now I am trying to use my senses, right? I'll think about it. Like, would this thing actually be a problem? Is this jam going to really be bad if it's a month out of date? Mm-hmm. No, it's not. I've been thinking about that a lot because it's good for my wallet, but it also hopefully is part of a bigger movement to make sure that we are using the resources that we produce and create really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is definitely going to make me think twice now before throwing things out. Alyssa Wilkinson is a writer at Vox. Alyssa, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
If you miss a day or two of Marketplace on the radio, first of all, how dare you? Second of all, no worries. You can always catch our podcast on the platform of your choice. Be sure to check it out. People are still not flying as much as they were before the pandemic, but the numbers this summer have been picking up. Yesterday, more than 1.7 million passengers went through TSA checkpoints, compared to about 500,000 last year at this time. And while the new Delta variant has changed plans for some people, the fact is a lot of folks are restless, looking to catch up on missed time and finally travel again. But to help navigate the ever-changing pandemic restrictions and COVID testing requirements, travel agents have been seeing a lot more business, which brings us to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Sarah Fazenden. I own Vidari Travel, and I'm based in Denver, Colorado. We design custom itineraries all around the world. Most of our clients are families, and they're looking to plan sort of big bucket list trips. And so in March, when it became crystal clear that the world was shutting down, then it was really, really horrible. We were dealing with canceling trips for the summer of 2020 into the fall, lots of rebooking, lots of travel insurance claims, and working to, you know, get vouchers. It was particularly painful. In many cases, we were giving clients back commissions that had already been paid. So going into the red on that front. We were all telling ourselves during the darkest days of 2020 that travel is important to people. And so we knew it was going to come back in full force. And about, I'd say probably in May, things really started to explode. It's bananas. It's been busy. It's just a wonderful thing. The volume is definitely increased, but the more significant thing that we're looking at is the total budget that families are allocating towards trips has increased significantly now in 2021 versus what we were seeing even in the first quarter of 2020. People are, you know, maybe spending an extra couple of days, they're traveling a bit further, they're adding on experiences that maybe they wouldn't have before. As a travel company, we do have fees that we charge in addition to commissions. So when people are spending more, that definitely makes a trip more profitable for us, for sure. The appeal of having a travel advisor right now, I think, is twofold. We have, for decades, established relationships with people around the world. And
our clients value the specialty that that brings to their itinerary. The second part of that, though, really is COVID. For a family traveling to Italy, for example, if children are unvaccinated, that means that they have to have a COVID test every 48 hours to go into museums or eat indoors at restaurants. And that is something that the team on the ground is coordinating. And so there's definitely this bigger picture. I'm investing a lot in travel, and I want to make sure that we're working with people who really know what they're doing. I feel like there is a bit of a growing concern about the Delta variant. It's potentially putting us into a situation, you know, that reminds us a little bit of 2020. We can't predict the future, but we've made it this far. So I feel good about what's to come.
That was Sarah Fazenden. She runs Vidari Travel out in Denver, Colorado. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out. As you've probably heard by now, more businesses around the country are now making it a requirement for employees and even its customers to be vaccinated. And to help figure out what business is doing what, Yelp recently released a feature to make things just a little easier. On the app, you can now filter restaurants and businesses based on whether they require proof of vaccination and if the staff is vaccinated. And you may think, this is an easy way for some people to leave hate and bad reviews for restaurants. And yeah, Yelp is fully expecting that to happen. There's even a name for it. It's called review bombing. They say they're planning to proactively monitor businesses that use these filters and take down any harmful reviews. Reviews that are about the restaurant's COVID-19 policies instead of, you know, the actual restaurant. All right, we are out of here. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Leanna Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. And I'm Rima Reis. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.